Morning. We're gonna try to start on time. What do you think? The hearing will come to order. Good morning and welcome to the third hearing in our series on securing the future of Social Security disability insurance. Today we'll focus on how disability is decided. For more than 50 years, the Social Security Disability Insurance Program has provided a vital safety net for workers who have worked long and recently enough and who meet the definition of disability. When Congress created the Disability Insurance Program in 1956, it defined disability as the inability of an individual to work due to a physical or mental impairment. Qualified impairments are those that are expected to last for no less than 1 year or those expected to result in death. Over the years, the Social Security Administration has created complex criteria, emphasize complex, and a time-consuming process that is frustrating to claimants, costly to the taxpayer, and frequently raises questions about the consistency, accuracy, and fairness of this program. Our witnesses today will tell us how claimants apply for disability, how the state disability determination agencies, which are fully funded by Social Security, decide eligibility. As we will hear today, deciding whether someone is eligible for benefits is far from easy. Examiners, supported by medical consultants, must analyze medical and other evidence and take a series of complicated steps to make their decisions. In the 1980s, Congress also created requirements relating to the opinion of treating doctors and how pain and other symptoms affect the ability of an individual to work. A morass of policies developed to help ensure consistency and respond to the courts have also added to the complexity of the program. It's no surprise, then, that there are wide variations in outcomes, raising questions about whether this program is being administered consistently across the country and whether claimants are being treated fairly. Further, Social Security has had an uphill climb for years to provide the kind of policy oversight, quality review, and ongoing training that massive disability workloads require. It's also struggled to stay current with needed updates to the list of medical conditions considered severe enough to qualify for benefits. While this program has served as a vital safety net to millions of Americans, the reality is that much has changed since 1956. Thanks to advances in medical care, many people with disabilities experience greater independence and as a result can live more productive lives. Legal and social changes have promoted participation by people with disabilities into the mainstream society, and the nature of work has changed significantly as we have moved from an economy largely defined by manual labor to a service and knowledge-based economy. Yet, the all-or-nothing standard of half a century ago is often criticized as work disincentive, furthering dependence by those who might otherwise be able to achieve varying levels of self-support. As we consider securing the future of this program, we owe it to the American public to ensure that the program effectively serves the interests of applicants, beneficiaries, and taxpayers. I now recognize the ranking member, Mr. Becerra, for his opening statement.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for calling this the third hearing in our series examining Social Security disability insurance system. I want to just begin by mentioning that the Social Security disability is an earned benefit. It is not something that you just get. You have to have paid into the system, which means you have to have worked to and paid into the system, and you must have suffered a work-ending disability to be able to qualify. Even so, the requirements for receiving benefits are very tough. You've mentioned that. Only the very sickest and most disabled Americans qualify. The majority of Americans with disabilities do not meet Social Security's strict eligibility standard. To qualify, applicants must submit detailed medical and other evidence demonstrating that they are either dying or too sick or disabled to work at all, and that their condition will last more than a year. Moreover, in deciding whether someone can work, SSA considers not just an individual's previous job or occupation, but whether he or she can assume any job in the nation's economy that could that individual could do despite the person's medical condition. Individuals who don't meet these criteria are not eligible for disability assistance from Social Security. Evaluating whether an individual is so sick or disabled that he or she cannot work is a difficult task, involving complex evaluations of medical evidence and other factors. DI benefits are not generous. A typical worker receives something about $13,000 a year, but because they are either too sick or too disabled to work at all, those benefits translate into a lifeline for many of those Americans and their families. We owe it to these Americans to pay their benefits when they need them. Let's remember that 1 in 7 beneficiaries of these disability benefits dies within a year of being awarded benefits. And we owe it to all Americans and workers who pay into the Social Security system to safeguard their contributions and pay only benefits to those who meet the strict standard. Social Security's operating budget is lower today than it was in 2010 because of decisions made in this Congress in what to appropriate and to how much to appropriate to the different agencies. That, to me, is alarming. At a time when Social Security is increasing its workload because of the economy, because of the number of individuals aging into the system, we're finding that the department's budget or the administration's budget is actually shrinking in its ability to meet the needs. That, I believe, is distressing. As I've said before, I think we owe it to the hundreds of millions of Americans who pay into the system or who receive benefits to hold hearings specifically on these critical decisions on budgets for the Social Security Administration. Americans' contributions into the trust fund are what pay for Social Security's operating expenses. Budget cuts have real consequences now and in the future for Social Security and its recipients. Initial disability claims, the topic of this hearing, are a good example. With an aging population and the worst recession since the Great Depression, the Social Security Administration receives over 3 million applications for disability benefits a year, an average of nearly 13,000 claims a day. Right now, it takes SSA an average of 111 days to make a decision on a disability application. Due to budget cuts, SSA has been operating under a hiring freeze, which means there are fewer workers to process claims, assist the public, and safeguard the trust fund than there were in 2011. The state DDS offices, which evaluate applications, have lost more than 10% of their staff compared to last year. This is the equivalent of about 2,000 skilled workers, many of whom have had years of experience. As a result, the amount of time it takes to make a decision on an application is rising, as is the backlog of people waiting for a decision, which is currently about 750,000 disabled individuals. Mr. Chairman, this is an important hearing. I believe that we must continue to take a close look at how the system operates. We have to make sure the benefits are there for those who need them, and I'm glad that we're holding this in the series of hearings on the Social Security Administration, and in this case, on the disability program. So with that, I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Becerra. As in customary, any member is welcome to submit a statement for the hearing record. Before we move on to our testimony today, I want to remind our witnesses, all of them, to please limit your oral statements to 5 minutes. However, without objection, all the written testimony will be made part of the hearing record. We have two panels today, and seated at the table is our only first panel witness, our Commissioner of Social Security, Michael Astrew. Welcome, Commissioner. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Johnson, Ranking Member Becerra, and members of the subcommittee, thank you for this opportunity to talk about our disability programs. These programs have become more complex and more people depend on them. Over the past 5 years, we have improved service despite limited resources and the huge influx of new disability claims. In addition to our core work, we have seen a drastic rise in our non-program work. Increasingly, our waiting rooms are filled not with people looking for help with retirement or disability, but with people needing verification so that they can qualify for federal, state, or local programs or for employment. Together, we need to figure out how to keep improving services as the population expands and baby boomers age. To succeed, we need experienced employees, up-to-date technology, and streamlined policies. We must make more and smarter investments in technology in order to best use our declining resources. Toward this goal, we are providing people with convenient online options. We are close to testing a uniform case processing system for DDSs. We're using electronic tools to help us better decide and document cases to improve quality. We're using technology to identify more and more cases for fast tracking. We're moving from pilots to permanent process with Health IT, which has the potential to make dramatic improvements both in quality and efficiency. These IT investments demonstrate that we understand that we can no longer do business as usual. Nevertheless, technology alone cannot make disability determinations. The complexity of the disability programs requires skilled employees to make those decisions. Unfortunately, after two straight years of less funding than we had in FY 2010, we will have lost 7,000 experienced employees who we cannot afford to replace. Rather than spend time on initiatives we cannot fund, we have focused on program simplifications. Some of these ideas we have implemented on our own. On others, we need your help. With your support, we can make other smart changes. The President's FY 2013 budget includes a legislative proposal, the Work Incentive Simplification Pilot, or WISP, which has great potential to encourage persons with disabilities to return to work. For several years prior to 2009, we received about 2.6 million initial disability claims each year. Since 2009, that level has increased dramatically to last year's nearly 3.3 million disability claims. To deal with this sharp increase, we added capacity to our DDSs and flexible national resources to help us quickly reallocate additional support to the most stressed states. The dedication of our DDS staff and support from our federal resources has helped us keep pending disability claims considerably lower than our original projected levels. Furthermore, our average processing time of 104 days, and that includes both the field office and the state DDS time, is near a record low since we began using that combined measure. Social Security remains a sound investment. We have drastically reduced the time claimants wait for a hearing decision. In FY 2011, we cut the average wait for a hearing below 1 year for the first time since 2003. Wait times are also down in field offices and our 800 number. Through the hard work of our employees and technological advancements, we have kept our administrative costs very low. However, we have increased employee productivity by about 4% in each of the last 5 years. Few, if any, organizations, public or private, have similar accomplishments. We are proud of these accomplishments and appreciate your confidence in us. The scope, sensitivity, and complexity of our programs requires well-trained people on the front lines and in key support roles. We simply cannot continue to lose so many employees and keep up. That challenge requires a complicated and ongoing conversation with Congress, which is why we are so pleased to participate in today's hearing. Before I conclude, I want to give you also an update on the Social Security Death Master File, which I testified about last month. After working closely with OMB and interested federal agencies, I'm pleased to announce that we have provided the subcommittee with our proposed legislative specifications designed to limit access to the Death Master File in order to reduce identity theft. The subcommittee's leadership on this important issue has guided our work, and we're grateful for it. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. As is customary for each round of questions, I will limit my time to 5 minutes and ask my colleagues to also limit their questioning time to 5 minutes. Commissioner, determining whether someone meets or equals the medical listings is a critical step in deciding disability. Advances in medical science and treatment are constant, so I was disappointed to learn from GAO's testimony that some of the listings have been extended repeatedly for the last 19 to 33 years without updates. In fact, two of the listings include those for mental impairment, which account for 21% of all claims, have not been comprehensively revised for more than 27 years. How in the world could updating these listings take that long, 19 to 33 years?
Well, it shouldn't, Mr. Chairman. And very early in my tenure, I made it a priority to change that longstanding practice in the agency. So on my management initiative, not because Congress said so, not because OMB said so, not because GAO said so, I set the standard for the agency of trying to be on a 5-year cycle of going forward in terms of updating our medical regulations. I worked in biotech for almost 15 years. I know how important it is to have updated medical information. And I think that, quite frankly, I think GAO's comments were a bit unfair. We did this on our own initiative. We've updated, if I remember correctly, 8 of the 14. We're making very good progress on the others. We won't, in all likelihood, quite hit 5 years, depending on when you decide those 5 years start. It might be 5.5 years. But considering there was catch-up, as you yourself pointed out, the regulations that hadn't been updated in 33 years, it will be easier and faster in the future when you only have to update for 3 to 5 years of medical advancement instead of going over 33 years, which is what we've been doing. And we've been trying to do this the right way. We've been trying to do this with a high degree of consensus, with participation from NIH, with patient advocacy groups. We've had relatively little complaint about this process. So I think that we've done this extremely well from a quality point of view. We're doing it extraordinarily quickly by historical standards. So I don't really think GAO has anything to complain about at all.
Do you have one or two people that look at that all the time?
We have a person who does nothing but manage the regulatory process named Paul Kriglick. He's overseen by our deputy for policy, David Russ. So we have a lot of people working on this. Could I do it faster if I had more people? Yes. We're doing the best we can with what we have.
Okay. In their testimony, GAO says Social Security's made several changes that hold promise, that's quote, for needed updates, yet GAO also raises questions about whether the new process will work. What changes are you making that you, and are you sure they'll work?
Well, I think if I understand the GAO, I mean, they've embraced the 5-year goal. That came from me. That comes from my management oversight of my people. I think in general they're doing a terrific job. So I'm not quite sure that there was a certain vagueness to the GAO criticism there. So I don't really, quite frankly, understand what it is that they're complaining about.
Well, they have to complain.
It's Washington. Silly me. I forgot.
To assess the functional demands of specific jobs, Social Security has long relied on the Dictionary of Occupational Titles maintained by the Department of Labor. Labor decided to replace this with a new system to track occupations, the Occupational Information Network, known as ONET. According to GAO's testimony, Social Security decided ONET was not detailed enough and would not be able to withstand legal challenges. As a result, Social Security, according to what we know, is now developing its own informational system for a cost of $108 million by 2016. Worse, the estimate doesn't include the cost of implementing or maintaining the system, which, according to Mr. Bottoni's testimony, could be significant based on other agencies' experience. So tell me, why can't Social Security use Labor's system instead of asking taxpayers to pay again to develop a separate system?
Well, quite frankly, the statute doesn't allow us to do it. ONET does not have the specificity that the statute requires in order to make the individualized determinations that we need. The Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which was developed in 1938, was always at best an imperfect fit for the system. It wasn't designed for us. It just happened to be convenient and there was some overlap. ONET is, by comparison to the DOT, very superficial and designed for even, it's further away from our purposes than the DOT is. So we've brought in outside experts to advise us on this. I've, except for a few consultants who thought they could make money off of this, no one has looked me in the eye and said, Commissioner, you can just substitute O-Net for DOT. That's, you know, a simplistic and simply wrong approach to something that's very complicated and important. And I think that this agency, and I think a lot of Washington, has had their heads in the sand about our vocational guidelines for a long time. The last update on this was 1991, and that was a superficial update. This has been a tool that needed work for a long time. No one was doing it. I'm not going to benefit from this. We've diverted a lot of resources into this, despite all the pressures to deliver in other areas, because it's critically important for the long-term future of the disability program to have, just to be as important as it is to be up to date on medical, it's important to be up to date for vocational. And there's no other way to do it than grind it out and do the hard work to do it right.
Well, ask labor to give you some money for it then.
Well, one of the things, Mr. Chairman, I've had this conversation with some committee staff, not on this committee, and there's this perception that's wrong, that there's this huge pool of untapped resources over at labor. Labor decided basically to get out of this business a long time ago. Even O-Net is done largely by contractors. So we've tried to work with labor as best we can. We've invited them into the process. But there is this misconception that there's this huge untapped pool of expertise at labor that we're not trying to take advantage of. And that's just simply not true.
No, I'm just worried about the cost involved.
Yeah.
Mr. Becerra, would you care to question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, thank you for being here, and thank you, by the way, for the work on the DMF, on that file, all those records of deceased individuals that have been used by people to invade people's privacy and steal their identity. The work you're doing, I think, will benefit many, many people, and we thank you for that. And the faster we can get to that, the better. If we can help you as you go around to the other departments and agencies to try to make sure that everyone works under the same standard so that we don't have people's death records being revealed and used by others for the wrong reasons, the better off I think all of us will be. So we look forward to working with you.
I think it took a little while, but I think the agencies are aligned now and we support this proposal. So what we need now is we need the Congress to move. So I would turn it around on you a little bit. We want to help you and your colleagues. I think there's bipartisan support, which is a little rare in this city right now, for doing something on this area. So I think it would be a great thing if we could find a way to all work together to try to make sure that this bill still passes this year.
It may surprise you, Commissioner, but I think Chairman would agree with that statement. I would too, that there can be bipartisan support on that particular issue. So I hope we're able to work with you to make something happen soon to protect people's identity. You mentioned earlier that your caseload has increased on the disability side. What were the numbers?
It's up to about 3.3 million applications.
As opposed to what?
2.6 to 2.65 before the recession hit.
So in the last two or three years, you've increased by almost a third, 25%.
We're taking in roughly 600 to 650,000 more cases than what the actuaries were projecting we would have in this time period before the recession hit.
So the recession has hurt. You were already going to increase because of the size of the baby boom population that was going to start working its way into the Social Security system, whether through disability or retirement. But on top of that, with the recession, double whammy. So now more people than you expected coming into the system.
Triple whammy, because we've got a lot more retirement applications because desperate older Americans are applying for retirement in higher numbers than we projected. And because we're doing so much verification for other federal, state, and local programs, which people are using more because of the recession, those workloads have gone up as well.
So I'm looking at your statement, your written statement on page two, where you talk about the budget, and you say at, toward the bottom there of page two, our fiscal year 2013 budget request is lean. You go on to say, while we will achieve goals associated with these priorities, we simply cannot do all of the work we are required to do. We expect to lose over 3,000 employees in fiscal year 2012, the current year, and over 2,000 more in fiscal year 2013, on top of the more than 4,000 employees we already lost in fiscal year 2011, a total loss of more than 9,000 Social Security and State Disability Determination Services employees in just 3 years. So while your caseload is rising, you're losing valuable and experienced personnel, and your budgets are shrinking. Your current budget from Congress is about $1 billion lower than what you requested, and it's lower than what it was in 2010. How does that affect if Congress isn't giving you money? And by the way, working men and women are contributing to the Social Security system every day through their paycheck contributions, and so it's not that there isn't the money there for Social Security to do its work, because everyone who sees that paycheck deduction, that FICA tax deduction, knows that they're paying for Social Security. But if Congress is shortchanging your budget, are you able to keep up with these caseloads?
The answer is we've done a remarkable job up to this point in keeping up. It's because of simplification, great work by the employees, a lot of things. But we can't keep this up indefinitely. And what I want to make sure that all of you understand is that we're probably 4 to 6 months away from moving significantly backwards in most of our major service metrics. Even if we keep up the 4% increase in productivity, which is an extraordinary achievement, and I'm not sure that we can do that, but even if we do, it's not going to be enough to compensate for all the people that we're losing so quickly.
So longer waits to get your determination on your disability, longer waits to be able to apply for your retirement benefits, longer waits to receive your surviving spouse benefits, probably more mistakes, because we know that the longer a case sits, the more likely that errors will be made in the determinations. And so it seems like some folks in D.C. are being penny wise but very pound foolish when it comes to services that most Americans have paid for. So I hope you'll continue to sound the alarm and get us the information that will help us make the right decision so that we don't shortchange our seniors and all those Americans who paid into the system for Social Security, whether disability, retirement, or surviving benefits. So I thank you, Commissioner, for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Becerra.
Commissioner, I want to just set the record straight. This year, Social Security received an increase in its budget despite a 1.5% decrease in overall discretionary cap. In fact, while Social Security is subject to the same long-term domestic spending caps enacted in the Budget Control Act, that same bill gave Social Security an additional $11 billion 2012 to 21 over the budget caps to increase continuing eligibility reviews in its DI and SSI programs. This year's appropriation bills were supported equally by both parties, including the President, the Democrat-led Senate, Ranking Member Levin, and Ranking Member Becerra. This even the President's fiscal year 2013 budget request is $753 million below your request of $12.5 billion. The fact is, our nation faces a sea of red ink that will break the back of our great nation unless we act now to get our fiscal house in order. The federal government has to live within its means, just like families do. That means doing more with less.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the fiscal needs, and certainly we live with whatever judgments Congress makes. But let me be clear, because I'm not sure it was clear from your statement. Our appropriation is smaller 2 years in a row. We had less in 2011 than we did in 2010, and we have less in 2012 than we did in 2011.
You've reduced your force, too, have you not?
Substantially.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, since we were out of order, if I could just comment ahead. As well, thank you. I think we also have to remember that Congress forced the Social Security Administration to use its reserves to try to continue to perform at a higher level. Those reserves were meant to help deal with any number of important activities that the Social Security Administration must perform. Those reserves are now gone, and so while
most of those were rescinded, we did not use, we used some of them, but most of the majority
of
them were rescinded, right?
Congress stripped them away from you, and so not only are you receiving less money in your budget, but money was taken away from you that you would have otherwise used for good purposes. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think let's be clear. We can try to paint this however we wish, and we should do hearings on this particular issue on the budget, because Americans have paid for the administration of the Social Security programs. This is not one of those areas where, because we're in fiscal red ink, that the Social Security Administration should suffer the consequences, because to this point today, Americans, through their taxes, have contributed more to Social Security than they've spent. And therefore, we shouldn't find that this agency, which does tremendous work for tens of millions of people, should all of a sudden have to make cuts to its services because it's getting shortchanged by a Congress for deficit spending unrelated to Social Security. So I think it's important, Mr. Chairman, that we continue to do these hearings. But as the Commissioner just said, there are consequences to these.
I believe it's your administration that cut back 2% too.
We can have those conversations later, but let's just agree on a bipartisan basis that we won't make cuts to Social Security that have no place when Americans have contributed to the system to pay for the services and the administration.
Thank you, Mr. Becerra. Mr. Berg, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to a different area.
Sure.
Commissioner Eltra, I understand that to implement the statutory definition of disability, Social Security has a regulatory framework and a listing of impairments considered severe enough to prevent an individual from working. So I have a few questions relating to the medical listings of impairments. First, would you say that these listings rely on objective medical findings and are less subjective to the judgment of the DSS examiner or the DDS examiner?
Yes, I think that's generally the notion. If we think something is clear enough that we can do a listing for, in other words, create a presumption, invariably there are at least substantially objective criteria that go into that. I wouldn't want to say that there's no subjective element, but it's substantially objective.
Higher standard from your point.
Yes, I think that's generally right.
So, I know that you've invested personally a lot of time and effort into the development of compassionate allowances.
Yes.
For disability. How do compassionate allowances differ from conditions in listings set forth by the regulations?
It's basically an expansion of the concept. So what we do is the listings historically would only apply to fairly common diseases and conditions. And what we found is that we were making a lot of mistakes in the aggregate in sort of rare diseases and conditions. So the notion was if on a one-time effort we went through to try to identify those diseases and conditions that pretty much by definition make you disabled, we now, because we're electronic, have the ability to pull those out at the front end and just allow them, and which is what we do. I think it's about 10 days now. So, but they're basically an extension of the philosophy of the listings. I think the differences are we've moved to much smaller diseases and conditions than what we would historically recognize. We've pulled them out electronically in the system, and we've set up procedures in the DDS so they're triaged at the front end, and so that's a very short amount of time for a decision.
So you have a more streamlined processing
procedure, right?
Too. Okay. Last, I've heard from constituents in North Dakota, and they're asking about the disability listing for Huntington's disease.
Yes.
And how do you decide to add a new listing?
Well, what we try to do is we look not only at the medical literature in detail, but we try to speak to the patient groups. Increasingly, we have a very broad and very productive partnership with NIH. So with Huntington's, I guess I'll jump on one of our announcements.
Sure.
So on April 11th, we're going to be announcing that we're adding juvenile Huntington's to the compassionate allowance list. So that's a first step. I've met with the Huntington's group, and I think the dilemma there is trying to figure out where to draw the lines, and I think that we think that we can do it, but actually it's one of those rare cases where it's harder because of technology. Now with the genetic tests, where a lot of people are getting diagnosed at a very young age, you can't give benefits consistent with the statute just with the genetic test that says you have Huntington's. Historically, it took so long to diagnose, Woody Guthrie or something. By the time they knew that Woody Guthrie had Huntington's, he was long gone and obviously disabled. Now with the new technology, we have to figure out exactly what symptoms with people with Huntington's make them unable to work. We haven't finished that process, but we're fairly optimistic that we're going to be able to do that. We've been in contact with both NIH and with the patient groups. My guess, that's in the neurological listings. My guess is that we'll have an NPRM out on that probably early next year would be the likely schedule.
Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Mr. Marchant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Commissioner, last week in our district work period, I spent most of my time visiting with senior groups. And in the conversation, usually in the question and answer section afterwards, in every instance, I had a senior that raised their hand that said they knew someone or some family that they were confident was receiving disability benefits, that they felt like that person was defrauding the Social Security system. The other question that came up was almost every one of them asked the question, is the rise, when in response to that question, I would use your statistic that we've had here, that there are 600,000 to 700,000 new claimants, more than there were, what was it, 10 years ago?
Then 3 years ago.
3 years ago. And that response brought on the question, then is the Social Security Trust Fund solvency threatened by the 600 to 700,000 more claimants? And the general attitude is that there is a fear among people that have worked their entire life that this segment, the disability segment itself, is threatening the entire integrity of the fund. Can you address that for me?
Sure. There's a mythology in a lot of quarters, and the media feeds this from time to time, that the system is rife with fraud, and that's just simply not true. Is there fraud? Well, sure. With a system this big and with standards this complicated, is there some small level of fraud? Yes. I think the level of fraud is much smaller than in most government programs. I think it's some fraction of 1%. And we do everything that we can to try to root those out. But I think what you have to be aware of is that increasingly, particularly as our society's and Congress's definition of disability has expanded, there are people who are legitimately disabled who don't look that way to their neighbors, and their neighbors make unfair conclusions. And you see this with people with a variety of mental conditions. You see this very typically, for instance, with people with early Alzheimer's. We even had a despicable case with one of our own medical examiners who saw someone with early Alzheimer's and just ridiculed the person. I apologized in a public hearing, you know, for the way one of our own people reacted, because we don't get it, we don't understand. So I think people are sometimes very quick to assume fraud when in fact what they're seeing is a non-apparent disability.
What about the issue of these claims threatening the solvency of the Social Security Fund?
My view is the level of fraud is so low that it's a rounding error in terms of the solvency of the system.
Okay. Setting fraud aside, what about the increased number of cases with the 0.90 payroll deduction? Are there statistics out there that say that the 0.90 raises this much money and this much money is coming out of the system based on that?
No, that's a good question. Something that should give you confidence in the integrity of the system is, as with the recession-related claims, which economists and others would say are, you know, typically would not meet our standards, if the system has integrity, then the allowance rates should drop. And our allowance rates have dropped during the recession, both at the DDSs and even more dramatically at the hearings and appeals level, because we are seeing more claims that are not meritorious. The increase in claims is not a result of any significant change that we've made or that you've made. 80 to 90% of the change, probably, and we'll supply more information to you about the record, is entirely predictable, has been predictable for decades. It's what the Office of the Actuary has been telling the Congress would happen, because people basically of my profile, you know, aging baby boomers, are in their disability-prone years. And so the amount of disability allowances we are seeing are relatively close to what the agency, CBO, and other experts have been predicting for a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Marchant. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner Astru, for coming here today and certainly for your service.
Thank you.
I appreciate the Social Security Administration's efforts, obviously, to expedite cases through the quick disability determination process. And obviously, I believe it's important we find ways to move the easily decided cases through the system more quickly. Can you speak to the safeguards that you might have in place to ensure that the system still can't be gamed, perhaps, amidst the kind of the fast track that we know probably needs to exist?
So I want to assure that's a very fine question. None of this happens on automatic pilot. As fast as this is, there is still a full medical review, not necessarily a full vocational review if it's not necessary, for instance, for a compassionate allowance. But for QDD cases, there's still a medical vocational analysis. It's just put up at the top of the queue. So we confirm all these medical analyses. We don't take the representation of the claimant as definitive. So I think it's a system with a lot of integrity. The other aspect to integrity that I think that's important, that's not statutory, not regulatory, but something that I think that you should know about and be concerned about for the future, is again, at a management level, we've set the threshold for the QDD cases as a 95% probability or more of allowance. There has been occasional internal and external pressure to lower that. And what I would tell you is that if you lower that and start damaging the integrity of the system, it might look good in the short run, but then I think you start damaging something that works really well. And I think the discipline of making sure that only the most likely cases are compassionate allowances or QDDs is an important one. And by doing it the right way, we're up to about almost 6%, I think, now of the cases decided in that way. I think by the end of next year, we'll probably be at 7%. It will start flattening. There's a natural end to it. But I think if you water down the system, you start damaging something that's really important for disabled people. So I hope in the future, you'll protect the integrity of the system and ask the agency in the future to maintain that 95% threshold.
Okay, thank you. Now, shifting gears a little bit in terms of the hearings backlog, and certainly you committed to eliminate the backlog and reduce the average time it takes, and there's some progress made, obviously. The productivity by ALJs has increased. Backlogs have been reduced, and waiting times for the hearing decision are down from over 500 days in 2008 to 345 days in 2011, so some progress. Conditions sometimes change, perhaps, but can you, in the 2013 budget request, I know that the hearings pending and hearing wait times will continue to decline, looking at that request, and yet the workloads pending and wait times will increase. Social Security has always worked to make the right decision as soon in the process as possible. Can you speak to that and how the budget request reflects the numbers?
Sure. You know, at some point, as much as we've tried to lay out a plan for what we can do, we've always said that it's contingent on a couple things. It's contingent on adequate funding from the Congress. It's contingent on an adequate supply of judges supplied by the Office of Personnel Management. Those are the two key variables. At some point, as the budget gets tighter, we're going to have to make hard choices about whether we back off from some of the 270 goal that we set for ourselves. And that's, I think, on the table for next year. I hope not. But, you know, it's not, my view is we've done, a much better job than I think most outsiders, most members of Congress expected 5 years ago when we started this process. And if you had said to me at the time, Commissioner, can you do this? Oh, and by the way, you're going to have the worst recession since the Great Depression, and you're going to have budget cuts for two straight years. Are you going to still be able to do this? My answer would have been, no, Congressman, I can't do it. But we're here. We've made great progress. The question of whether we can get from approximately 345 days to 270 days in the next year and a half will turn a lot on the funding situation. Reminds me, you know, when I was general counsel of HHS, I had in my closet a cartoon wall, and my favorite was a lawyer looking at a client, and he looked at the client and said, well, how much justice can you afford? And that's basically where you are. If you want justice, if you want 270 days, then you can get that, but you have to support the budget to get there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Time of the gentleman's has expired. How about Mr. Teaberry is recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner, for your service. Thank you for being here. I want to make just a couple points and then ask a question. One of the best things that Social Security has ever done is provide those of us who pay into Social Security, and yes, congressmen pay into Social Security, even though there's a long-standing myth that we don't. When I get my statement, I got my statement last summer, the notice there that says that I'm going to get this much money based upon quarters that I put in and what I've paid in. But then the little asterisk that says if nothing is done by the time you are scheduled to turn 67, doesn't say 67, but by the time you're ready to retire at full retirement, you will only get 72% of your benefit. I think that's great. I wish you would actually put that bigger on the, if there's any way to do that, because I think that illustrates that there is a problem with the future of funding Social Security. Not just for me, but for my four daughters, if we do nothing. So I think that's a great service, and I would hope that you'd highlight that better. And obviously, we're here to talk about the Disability Fund, which is even, according to the Congressional Budget Office, in worse shape than the Retirement Fund. In my office, I have a caseworker who has been doing Social Security long before I got elected to Congress, was working for my predecessor. And he says, anecdotally, that he can count on three out of every four constituents who come in to our office to seek help will ultimately get denied initially, and then we'll go to an appeal. And a majority of those, again, anecdotally in our office, who go through the appeal process will ultimately get awarded. So in relation to that context that I just gave you, when you have numbers that have been provided to us that it takes about $1,050 to process a DDS claim on average initially upfront, so it's about $1,000, a little over $1,000, that claim is processed in a little over 100 days. Through our office, at least, most of those are denied initially. Then they go to an appeal. That appeal through a judge cost about three times as much, three times as long. In view of those numbers, and those are national numbers in addition to what we see in our office in terms of the time frame, is there an inconsistency in this process? Do we need to look at what the DDSs are doing versus the appellate process? To make that system maybe more efficient? Are they not trained the same? Is there some sort of breakdown between that initial process and the appeal process? Can we streamline this process to make it more cost-effective, more timely?
I'm tempted to answer yes to most of those questions, but let me say this. So different iterations of that question we've been dealing with for a long time. And I do think that we've made some significant progress. Compared to 5 years ago, quality in the DDSs is up substantially. We have additional quality initiatives or quality-related initiatives in the pipeline. The most important one is that we're moving from a fragmented, antiquated, 54-siloed IT system to a state-of-the-art unified system that builds in the best practices that we know work. The most important one is something called ECAT, which uses basic artificial intelligence techniques to prompt examiners with everything that they need to know when something comes up relevant to, if multiple sclerosis comes up or rheumatoid arthritis comes up or whatever, tells them everything they need to know, and in fact requires, for quality reason, documentation of certain things if our rules require it, to in essence prevent examiners from taking shortcuts. So the quality is getting better in the DDSs, and I think they've done a great job. It is also helping the fast tracks that Mr. Berg and others have mentioned have been a big help in terms of quality. Because when I came in and there was some resistance to doing the compassionate allowances, we did a retrospective study and we found that on the things that were on my list, our error rate, instead of at that point it was about 6% in the DDSs, it's probably about 20 to 40% was the range, and most of them were closer to 40%. So picking out those rarer things and giving precise guidance, those things help. Ohio may be, I mean, by definition, you're going to see the close cases. Ohio may be a little worse than some other states. Ohio's one of the states that did a lot of furloughs. That had damaged morale, increased turnover, aggravated backlogs, meant more acrobatics in terms of staffing and higher costs to get things done. So it may be a little worse in Ohio at the DDS because of that. I think it's moving in the right direction now. And one of the things you should be real happy about, one of the real success stories, is 5 years ago, Columbus was probably one of the six worst hearing offices in terms of backlog in the country, made enormous progress, about 500 days off the wait time. And you should particularly go and thank the new chief judge over there, Judge Allen, because this is one of those cases where one person with backbone and management talent has made an enormous difference.
Great point. I appreciate that. You're right about that. The only thing that's depressing for me is when my caseworker has to tell people up front that, you know what, you're probably going to get denied when you initially apply because that's what usually happens. That's kind of unfortunate.
It's about
reality.
Statistically, it's about one in three. I know it feels differently. I think because you don't get a representative sample.
That's probably true.
In hearing offices. But it's about one in three at the DDSs, and right now the allowance rate is about 50-50 on appeal. It's about 51% are allowed on appeal. Oh. And again, some of that is rational. People who are severely ill, that's not a static situation. And particularly as the timelines stretch out, their situation changes. And the obligation of our people along the way is not to decide whether the previous decision was right, but to look at it fresh and new. So it's not necessarily inconsistent. Sometimes it is.
Thank you.
But it's not necessarily inconsistent when an ALJ comes to a different decision from an examiner.
Gentleman's time's expired.
Sorry about that.
Mr. Becerra, you're recognized for 30 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By the way, Commissioner, thank you very much for your visit to Los Angeles and the offices that we have there in Los Angeles and the work that you're doing with them. Just a quick point, maybe we can follow up because we need to move on. I know you've instituted a new policy that will withhold the names of the administrative law judge to Americans who are filing their claims or to their representatives as they try to move through the appeal process. I know there's some concern as to whether or not some folks are trying to judge shop who will conduct the hearing for that appeal. But I think it may have been overly broad in its approach in targeting both in-person and video hearings, because that sounds to me like the concern with judge shopping may be more related to video hearings than the in-person hearings. And I'm hoping that maybe we can talk further, because I don't think that what we want to do is end up with more errors in the decision-making, a more arduous process for folks who don't have a lot of money. And I know that what we want to do is make sure that the appeals process works in the most efficient and adequate way forward, and perhaps we can talk about that later.
Always happy. You've got my number. Call anytime.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, thank you for being here. You're doing a great job.
Thank you. And I appreciate all the support from members of this committee. It does make a huge difference for us in a lot of big and small ways. So thank you for what you do as well.
Thank you. We'll now proceed to our second panel. You'll be excused. Thank you, sir. Our witnesses who are taking their seats at the table are Trudy Lionheart, Director of the Office of Disability Determination Services at the Vermont Agency of Human Services, on behalf of the National Council of Disability Determination Directors. Lisa Ekman, who is a Senior Policy Advisor for Health and Disability Advocates, on behalf of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities Social Security Task Force. Dan Bertoni, the Director of Education, Workforce and Income Security Issues at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Dr. Layton Chan, who is Chief of the Rehabilitation Medicine Department at the National Institute of Health. Dr. Nicole Mastas, who is a senior economist with the RAND Corporation, all the way from Santa Monica, California. You brought the rain. Thank you. Ms. Lionheart, welcome. Please go ahead. You're recognized. Punch a button down there.
Hello? There we go. Okay. Chairman Johnson, Ranking Member Becerra, and members of the subcommittee, I'm Trudy Lionheart, President-elect of the National Council of Disability Determination Directors, NCDDD, and Director of the Vermont Disability Determination Services. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the administrators of the Disability Determination Services, the DDSs, of the states and the District of Columbia. Collectively, we direct the work of over 14,000 employees, processing nearly 4.8 million disability cases a year, including initial claims, reconsiderations, and continuing disability reviews, CDRs. DDSs make determinations with high accuracy, ensuring that over a million deserving disability applicants get benefits quickly each year. In any given year, over 70% of the allowance determinations in the disability program are made at the DDS level, with no need for an administrative law judge hearing. DDS accuracy, speed, and volume are notable considering the program's complexity. Adjudicators must obtain healthcare records and detailed descriptions of daily activities and work history, arrange for consultative exams if needed, analyze reams of electronic evidence, in the process evaluating symptoms, weighing different medical opinions, assessing medical severity, and determining individuals' remaining work capacity. Social Security and the DDSs have historically worked together to provide the American public with prompt, accurate, and cost-effective service. However, our ability to continue to do so is now increasingly threatened. Funding in the FY12 budget will not cover all the cases the DDSs will receive. The deeper cuts scheduled to occur in 2013 per the Budget Control Act will dramatically worsen the situation. In early FY11, SSA imposed a hiring freeze, extending even to replacement hiring. Since then, the DDSs have lost over 2,000 employees. Three quarters were examiner losses, a lost capacity of over 900,000 case determinations a year. Already, many thousands of cases are delayed in growing DDS backlogs. Recently, with the release of the FY12 budget, SSA authorized 200 DDS hires nationally. These hires, while appreciated, are a drop in the bucket. With the DDS situation so fragile, further increase in our medical CDR workload is a concern. We would need both additional funding and advanced hiring. Our pipeline of disability examiner trainees has been empty for a year and a half, and examiners are not quickly replaceable. It takes a minimum of several years of training and mentoring before they have the knowledge and skills to handle all cases, especially CDRs. For as long as they can, the DDSs will continue to keep cases moving and meet workload targets. DDS staffs are highly skilled and extremely elastic. In the short term, we have shifted some support resources to case processing, but this is not sustainable. With insufficient funding for the incoming cases, continued attrition, and only minimal replacement hiring, the DDSs will reach a tipping point with burgeoning backlogs and case delays. Policy changes would make the process more efficient. NCDDD continues to recommend consistent application of policy across the nation and across all appeal levels. Our written testimony includes recommendations in such areas as policy simplification, enhancement of technology tools, expansion of the medical listings, extension of single decision maker authority, and reinstatement of the reconsideration in the 10 prototype states. Last year alone, the DDS has allowed over 92,000 claimants at the reconsideration step, an invaluable service. SSA and the DDSs have a long history of accomplishment working together to provide high-quality service and careful program stewardship. This relationship has never been more important. Collaborative strategy is crucial if we are to find ways to continue this service on which the American public relies. Policy changes and technology tools can further improve program efficiency and consistency, but the foundation must be adequate funding and highly trained staff. On behalf of NCDDD, thank you again for the opportunity to provide this testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Ekman, welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson, Ranking Member Becerra, and members of the subcommittee. Thank you for this opportunity to testify at this very important hearing. My name is Lisa Ekman, and I'm a senior policy advisor for Health and Disability Advocates. I testify today on behalf of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities Social Security Task Force. The Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSDI, program provides vital economic security and access to health care for individuals whose impairments are so severe that they preclude substantial gainful work. The importance of SSDI to people with disabilities cannot be overstated. I would like to begin by sharing the stories of two SSDI beneficiaries with you and tell you a little about the difference SSDI made in their lives. First, there's the story of Angelise P. Angelise was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes as a teenager. She went to college and she worked for many years. 2 years ago, when she was 36, she had to be hospitalized for diabetes-related complications. Angelise spent a long time in the hospital, due in part to the fact that she continued to work when she should have stopped because it was aggravating her diabetes. As a last resort, Angelise applied for benefits while she was in the hospital. Due to the severity of Angelise's diabetes, she was approved for SSDI benefits. Angelise came very close to becoming homeless when she couldn't work due to her diabetes. Fortunately, she was able to keep her apartment, but only because a charity helped support her and pay her rent. She received a quick decision regarding her eligibility, and because of SSDI, she was able to keep her home. Angelise receives just around the average SSDI benefit of just over $1,000 per month. Her rent is $550. Her SSDI allows her to live in her home, but she squeaks by. Without SSDI, she would be homeless. It is with sadness that I tell you that last night Angelise passed away due to diabetes complications. But in the 2 years that she received SSDI, it made a tremendous difference in her life. There's also the story of Henry H. Henry is in his 60s and has severe cardiac problems. He was working in the insurance industry for a long time, but was not able to keep his job due to his heart condition. Henry spent all of his savings and cashed out his 401k before he applied for SSDI benefits. When he filed his application as a last resort, he was homeless and living in his car. He lived there for about a year. Once his SSDI benefits were approved, Henry was able to secure housing again and has not been homeless since. Given the importance of SSDI to people with disabilities like Angelise and Henry, I want to highlight three key points. First, providing the Social Security Administration, or SSA, with adequate administrative budget is essential to accurate and timely initial processing of SSDI claims. Second, the current definition of disability and structure of the SSDI program are appropriate and should not be changed. Third, SSA does a good job of administering the program, but improvements could be made. First, as has been discussed quite a bit during the commissioner's testimony, SSA requires an adequate administrative budget to effectively administer the SSDI program and complete initial disability determinations in an accurate and timely manner. We were pleased to see the progress SSA was able to make during fiscal years 2008 and 2010 in reducing the time for people with disabilities to receive their disability determinations. Unfortunately, as discussed, SSA has received no increase and although debate over whether it was a decrease, no increase in their funding since 2010, and we are likely to see an increase in the processing time for initial disability applications because the funding, as discussed, is completely inadequate to keep up with SSA's workload. Second, because the intent of the SSDI program is wage replacement and to provide income support for individuals who do not have the capacity to engage in substantial gainful work, the current definition of disability is appropriate. The definition is strict, providing benefits only to individuals with the most significant impairments. However, keep in mind that just because an individual has an impairment does not mean that they will be eligible for benefits. Neither Angelis nor Henry would have been eligible for benefits if their impairments were less severe and did not prevent them from working. Third and finally, both SSA and the State Disability Determination Services do a good job of administering the SSDI program, especially given the resources they have available. However, we encourage SSA to make some modest changes to ensure that medical evidence is fully developed early in the process so that unnecessary delay and unnecessary and costly appeals can be avoided. Such modest changes include providing more assistance to claimants earlier in the process, providing better guidance to doctors and other professionals regarding what evidence SSA is looking for, and by providing additional and improved training to disability evaluators. Our written testimony contains additional recommendations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I look forward to answering any questions you might have.
Thank you, ma'am. Dan Bertone, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Becerra, members of the subcommittee, good morning. I'm pleased to discuss our preliminary findings on the Social Security Administration's efforts to modernize Last year, SSA paid nearly $170 billion to about 12 million beneficiaries and dependents. And given the size and cost of its programs, its current criteria assess whether an applicant's medical condition affects his or her ability to work. In 2003, we designated SSA's disability programs high risk, in part because its criteria for determining medical eligibility, medicine and technology, and its occupational information did not reflect changes in the labor market. My statement today addresses SSA's most recent efforts to update its medical listings and develop its own occupational information system to better reflect the existence of jobs in the national economy. In summary, the agency has made several changes to improve the effectiveness of its medical listings updates, such as adopting a two-tier system that first includes a review of all disorders under a body system and making appropriate revisions, then on an ongoing basis conducting subsequent targeted reviews of that body system focusing only on a limited number of conditions. And to date, the agency has completed comprehensive reviews for 8 of 14 body systems. To the targeted phase. In 2010, SSA also established a five-year cycle for updating its listings to ensure a more systematic consideration of advances in the treatment and evaluation of conditions. The agency also contracted and has acted on several of their recommendations, such as creating a standard to review and provide advice on the listings. However, SSA still faces challenges keeping its listings up to date and has yet to complete revisions for six body systems, which in many cases have been ongoing for decades. Moreover, despite multiple extensions, four body systems were expired in 2012, and it's uncertain whether SSA will complete the required reviews. The agency has also experienced delays with its targeted reviews and slippage in its plans to conduct post-implementation evaluations of previously revised listings. SSA has noted that challenges in this area are mainly due to limitations in the number and expertise of staff needed to update the listings and complexity of the regulatory process. And as you know, the agency has begun an ambitious project to develop its own occupational inventory database by 2016. It will replace an outdated system it currently uses. In 2008, SSA took steps to guide the development of this Occupational Information System, or OIS, to capture both the physical and mental demands of work and better support its disability decisions. Accordingly, SSA established an advisory panel of external experts tasked with making recommendations on developing the system and held initial meetings with outside experts and other agencies that collect occupational information to gain insight into sampling methods and other challenges. And last year, the agency issued a research and development plan detailing activities necessary to complete this phase by 2016 at a cost of $108 million. To date, they've made progress on several fronts, including using its own administrative data to identify the most frequently cited occupations and functional and vocational characteristics of its applicants. However, due to staffing constraints, several planned initiatives have slipped, and officials noted that further timeline adjustments are likely. To offset this challenge, SSA has used consultants with specialized expertise and is working with OPM to obtain additional staff skilled in industrial organizational psychology on a part-time basis. And finally, in the course of our work, we have identified some gaps in SSA's approach, such as insufficient documentation supporting SSA's research and development cost estimate, and the absence of any information on total cost of the project over time. We will continue to pursue these and other issues as our work progresses, including how SSA is managing the OIS against best practices and ensuring that the project schedule reliably estimates key activities and the length of time they will take. Finally, we plan to review any risk analyses conducted by the agency, as well as mitigation plans to address identified risks, including how this complex project will proceed should funding be reduced. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement. I'm happy to answer any questions that you or other members of the subcommittee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Chan.
Yes,
you're recognized, sir.
Chairman Johnson, Ranking Member Becerra, and members of the subcommittee, I'm honored to have the opportunity to appear before you today to testify about NIH's collaboration with the SSA. The SSA approached NIH in late 2007 for advice on new assessment methods that might inform their disability evaluation process. The NIH Clinical Center's Rehab Medicine Department agreed to help and based our work on widely adopted contemporary disability concepts. Our collaboration has been facilitated by an interagency agreement that was initiated in February of 2008. And I want to note that this area we're talking about today is just one of many factors that SSA takes into account in their statutory role to ensure that the agency's disability evaluation standards reflect appropriate medical and vocational information. So currently, the SSA disability determination process is linked to a claimant's diagnosis or their impairment. However, a diagnosis or impairment may no longer be so closely connected to an individual's ability to work as it has been in years past. The concept of disability has evolved over the last few decades, and this evolution has now culminated in an international agreement. In 2001, the World Health Organization adopted a landmark standard called the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health, or the ICF. The ICF has been endorsed by all 191 WHO members, including the United States. The ICF considers disability to be the result of not only a person's diagnosis, but also two other very important factors: the impact that diagnosis has on their ability to function and the environmental demands placed on them in their workplace. It is this ICF theoretical construct that really informs our collaboration with SSA. Our work with the SSA has several components. One of the most important projects is a direct attempt to create a rapid, reliable, an objective functional assessment tool that SSA could use one day in real time. To do this, we've engaged colleagues at Boston University to help us develop a series of computerized functional assessments that utilize something called item response theory and computer adaptive testing, or IRT-CAT. The scientific evidence validating IRT-CAT instruments has been available for decades. If you've recently taken the SAT or the GRE or the LSAT, you've taken an IRT-CAT test. The theory is really quite simple. If you want to assess an individual's capabilities regarding a single characteristic, let's say their ability to lift 300 pounds, and you need to know that in 1 pound increments, well, you could ask 300 separate questions. That would give you a very precise estimate, but it would take some time. Item response theory utilizes information gathered in prior questions to determine what questions should come next. So for instance, you might ask that same individual, can you lift 50 pounds? If the answer to that question is yes, you might, and the next question might be, can you lift 100 pounds? If the answer to that is no, the next question might be, can you lift 75 pounds, and so on. By asking 5 or 6 questions rather than 300, you can determine how much that person thinks that they can lift. IRT-CAT tests have a significant advantage to the SSA. In addition to administering them to claimants, the SSA might also apply these same tests to clinicians to obtain their functional assessment of the claimant. This, I think, information could add an important perspective to a person's disability claim. Our team is currently in the process of creating 2 initial IRT-CAT instruments. They will assess a claimant's interpersonal interaction skills and their mobility. These 2 topics were selected because of the high relevance they have to SSA's current applicant pool. For these topics, assessments questions have been developed and the calibration tests are being completed. We'll calibrate the tests not only to SSA claimants but also to the population as a whole, after which we'll put together the IRT-CAT instruments themselves. An RFP, a request for proposal, is currently posted for the development of 4 additional IRT-CAT instruments that will cover all the remaining topics in the IFC related to work disability. These topics will likely include self-care, communication, learning and applying knowledge, and general tasks and demands. We hope to have much of the initial work for all six IRTCAT instruments completed by 2016. Mr. Chairman, this completes my prepared remarks. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today and provide an overview of our work with the SSA. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Mastis, welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson and Ranking Member Becerra, for this opportunity to testify. I will address my comments to the question of consistency in the initial disability determination process, drawing on recent RAND research. DDS case examiners are called on to evaluate and weigh many aspects of complex cases against extensive medical and vocational criteria in a dynamic medical environment. They have heavy caseloads, and although they may consult with physicians, they are not themselves trained physicians. Moreover, as the SSDI caseload has grown, the composition of applications has shifted toward impairments with greater diagnostic uncertainty. Chief among these are musculoskeletal and mental impairments, which now comprise 59% of all applications. Given these factors, some variation in decision outcomes across DDS examiners is expected. Nonetheless, it is worth trying to minimize the extent of variation as much as possible. In our analysis of initial disability determinations recorded in SSA's Disability Operational Data Store in 2005 and 2006, we find a notable degree of variation in initial outcomes across DDS examiners within the same office. This variation cannot be explained by differences in the mix of cases they evaluate. We find that after adjustments for case mix, one-third of examiners have allowance rates more than 6 percentage points above or below the average allowance rate in their DDS, and as many as 5% of examiners have allowance rates more than 12 percentage points above or below the average. As a result, for many applicants, whether they are allowed or denied benefits depends upon the examiner to which their case is assigned. While most examiners have initial allowance rates near the average for their DDS office, some do not. This means that most applicants would receive the same initial determination if their application had been assigned to a different examiner. But even so, due to the examiners who are not near the average, we estimate that as many as 60% of applicants could have received a different initial determination from at least one other examiner in the DDS office, had they been assigned to that examiner instead. The magnitude of this measure is driven by the examiners who have the lowest and highest allowance rates in a DDS office. For example, if we remove from our calculations the top and bottom 1% of DDS examiners, those with the highest and lowest allowance rates, then the percent of applicants whose initial decision depends on the examiner they're assigned to would fall by half, from 60% to 28%. As you'd expect, the appeals process significantly dampens the effect of examiner variation. In our administrative data, nearly two-thirds of all initial denials are appealed, and 75% of these are eventually overturned. Once we account for appeals, we estimate that only 23% of applications could have received a different ultimate outcome, that is, accounting for appeals, had they been assigned to a different examiner. And if we again remove the highest and lowest allowing examiners in an office, this number falls to 11%. These figures illustrate two points. First, although most examiners have allowance rates that are near the average for their DDS office, many have allowance rates that are notably below or above their office average, even after adjusting for differences in case mix. Because an applicant could potentially be assigned to one of these examiners, applicants face significant uncertainty as to whether their application will be initially allowed or denied. Improving consistency across examiners would significantly reduce this uncertainty about initial outcomes. Second, it bears emphasizing that these statistics are not estimates of the fraction of applicants who should have been denied. Rather, they identify the size and characteristics of the group that would be most affected by changes in the policies and procedures used in initial disability determinations. This group disproportionately includes younger claimants, claimants with very low earnings histories, and claimants with mental impairments. At present, the variation in examiner allowance rates and the high probability of having an initial denial overturned on appeal means that it is usually worthwhile for denied applicants and their attorneys to pursue appeals. But the appeals process, as you know, is costly. From the time that an SSDI application is filed to the time a final determination is made, an applicant may not earn more than $1,000 per month in paid employment, since this would exceed the SGA threshold and result in denial of benefits. In our administrative sample of SSDI applicants who received initial decisions in 2005, The average time from SSDI application to final determination exceeded 1 year. But while those who did not appeal waited an average of only 4 months, those who did appeal waited an average of 2 years before receiving a final determination, that is after exhausting all appeals. Time spent out of the labor force while seeking benefits may have detrimental effects on employability. Indeed, we find that longer application processing times reduce the employment of SSDI applicants in the years after their initial decision. Our calculations suggest that the SSDI determination process itself reduces the post-application employment of denied applicants by an average of 3.6 percentage points in years 2 and 3 after the initial determination, and similarly reduces the average employment of allowed applicants by 5 percentage points. In sum, by reducing the variation in initial determinations, we would improve the targeting of the SSDI program. That is, we would increase the chances that people who truly qualify receive benefits and reduce the chances that those who don't truly qualify receive benefits. To the extent that decision thresholds could be better aligned between the initial and appellate phases, the share of those initially denied applicants who decide to appeal would likely decline, and the detrimental effects on future employment potential would be reduced. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Did you listen to Dr. Chan? Did you agree with his?
I did. I was actually quite excited by what I was hearing.
Dr. Chan, you testified about the collaboration between Social Security, the National Institute of Health, and Boston University to develop your computer test. Are you saying by taking a test, Social Security can credibly assess a claimant's ability to function in a matter of minutes?
So I think that the techniques and the procedures behind IRTCAT instruments are well validated. They've been utilized in educational arenas for quite some time. We've been using them in healthcare for quite some time. They are remarkably powerful and insightful tools that can be done very, very quickly, particularly in the area of functional assessment.
Can people fake them?
Well, our job really was to look at functional assessment, determine a technique for functional assessment. Clearly, there is no functional assessment tool that would be completely immune to gaming. On the other hand, there are, I think, several aspects to IRTCAT that are really beneficial in this area. The first would be that the IRTCAT instruments themselves are comprised of dozens, if not hundreds, of questions that would be very difficult to memorize, and indeed it would be very difficult to figure out the order that those questions might come in. Second, we could also give these same assessment tools to the claimant's clinicians. And that would provide very interesting information, I think, and useful for SSA in validating certain things. And in addition, we would be applying these tests to millions of individuals, so we would probably have some really wonderful baseline data looking at what a normal response pattern would be. And so individuals who have aberrant response patterns potentially could be identified and
does it just take one person to do the test?
Excuse me?
One person to do the test.
Yeah, so mostly it would be claimants who would be doing the tests, but for those individuals.
Well, I understand that, but the person doing the testing on the testing side.
Oh, on the testing side. In general, these are computer-administered tests, and so somebody.
So one person can do them.
Yeah, a person can do them by himself, if that's what you're asking. Yeah.
They have to be trained?
Well, we tailor these tests so they're at a relatively low and easy level. Obviously, we need to do that so that a broad range of individuals
can
that's
the kind of test we need up here.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that, Doctor?
I think this sounds quite promising.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Becerra, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I can't get quite as excited on the numbers, but it sounds like the two of you work with a great deal of numbers, and I'm glad it raises your blood pressure a bit to see that we might have some opportunities. I do think, though, it is, as you said, quite promising, Dr. Maestas, that we might have other ways to try to validate the process. What I take from what every one of you have said is that this ain't easy to do. You're, in many cases, making judgments, because you're looking at folks who are maybe right on the edge. Could they work, and not just in their current occupation, but in some capacity whatsoever? And it's sometimes not an easy call to make. And so what we're trying to do is make the system as efficient and standardized as possible, so that way when folks have to make the decision, they're not guessing. They should be collecting the information as early as possible to try to help these determiners, those who make the determinations, have all the information, the evidence that they need. And certainly we have to make sure that we continue to push the SSA to have the tools in place that let them effectively make those judgments, because we're talking life and death, as I think Ms. Ekman made clear in most cases. I'm troubled, though, that what we're hearing is that SSA is having to try to do all of this with less and less money. Ms. Lionheart, you mentioned that SSA is already struggling. You've already seen a number of these folks who work to make determinations gone. Have you been losing folks with little experience or lots of experience?
It's a mix, but just as the baby boomers are getting more disabled, they're also leaving our offices. So I would say it's probably heavy on the, I don't have exact numbers, I could get them for you probably with some polling of my members, but what I hear is that they're losing experienced examiners.
And so it's not as if when you do a hire, you've automatically compensated for the loss of that seasoned examiner.
Correct.
This worries me, because we were making progress. We were getting the wait time down, the backlog down, and I believe, Ms. Lionheart, you also mentioned that the longer a case sits, the greater the chance that we're going to make some mistakes with it, or it's going to become more difficult to adjudicate.
It was not me that testified that we would make more mistakes, but it definitely takes longer. You end up refreshing the medical evidence and getting more information. It becomes more complicated at the longer it sits.
Yeah, and so what I take from everything you're saying is that we have to continue to find the tools that let us make these assessments to try to avoid the outlier decisions, whether in denial or granting the benefits, so that we have more consistency. But at the same time, don't tie the administration, Social Security Administration's hands behind its back as it's trying to move forward with an increasing caseload of individuals who are filing for claims. We want to make sure that those who deserve it get it. At the same time, we want to make sure that those who don't deserve it don't clog the system for those who are waiting to get the benefits they've earned. Ms. Ekman, you brought up some real cases, and I think it's important to know that we're talking about real people who were affected, who paid into the system, who are now applying for those benefits that they worked to have. What's your sense out there in the community of folks who are on the verge of securing these disability benefits, or believing that they may on the verge of having to apply for these disability benefits? Is there some concern about where we may head in the future?
Thank you for the question, Congressman Becerra. I'm not sure that for the people who are going to be applying for benefits that that's a concern. They're concerned about, how do I pay my rent? How do I get my medication?
Good point.
I think, though, for advocates, there is a huge concern that the longer that the Social Security Administration and the state DDSs remain underfunded, the worse the conditions will get, the longer people will have to wait. And it is not an overstatement to say that people die while they're waiting for a disability determination. So there is definitely a sense that we need to provide adequate resources to SSA and the DDSs to ensure that they can make accurate and timely decisions so that people who desperately need the benefits can get them.
And one final question. I know that the Social Security Administration, in an effort to try to concentrate the resources it has on those services that are most important, has had to make other decisions which are tough. They're closing offices at earlier hours. They're less able to respond to people who are applying for retirement benefits, so they can deal with those who are seeking disability benefits and the sort. Ms. Lionheart, do you think at some point it's going to become very obvious to the average American who is getting ready to apply for his or her Social Security benefits that there is a problem with Social Security because its budget is being so short-changed?
I do think it will be obvious if it is not already.
Thank you. Well, I thank you all for your testimony. I hope that research can produce some real results sooner than later so we can apply those. And Mr. Chairman, I thank you for bringing these witnesses.
Thank you. Mr. Berg, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one question. Dr. Mainz-Tess, my question is, when someone's seeking disability insurance, you know, it takes a long period of time. And there's a detrimental effect on their skills during this period and their ability to be employed. And so my question is, if you could tell us a little bit more about these findings and your research that looks at that, and then also what is it we can do about that?
So it's been known for some time that many SSDI recipients have some employment potential. We're not talking about full-time employment potential at the level of their pre-disability earnings necessarily, but those effects are rather large. So for example, we estimate that had many beneficiaries, and these are the relatively healthy of the disabled beneficiaries, that had they not received benefits, their employment rate could increase by as much as 28 percentage points. Okay, so again, not to full-time employment capacity. If you look at annual earnings, it's an increase in annual earnings of about $3,700. Okay, for many people, this won't rise above the SGA threshold, although for many people it would. And what this new research is saying, that in addition to these effects of benefit receipt on employment potential and employment capacity, there are additional effects coming from the process itself that keeps people waiting. So we've been able to disentangle these two components to get an estimate of the decay in employability that arises with every month that somebody waits for a final decision. Now, the problem is not the initial decisions per se yet, because those occur relatively quickly. The problem is that when someone gets a denial, and of course most people do get a denial from the initial determination process, they go on to appeal. And the appeals process kicks them into this waiting game that goes on a very long time. If they are denied at the ALJ level, many of them go on to pursue appeals at the higher federal court levels. So it's well known in economics that as people stay out of the labor force, and of course these people have to stay out of the labor force while they're pursuing appeal because otherwise they'd be denied, employability declines, skills depreciate, employment networks erode, investments in the latest information and technologies aren't made.
What do we do about it? What's the solution?
It's a hard problem, admittedly, but we have to shorten processing times. We have to shorten waiting times. But part of this is not, it's not only about, the administration has made good attempts in this area to actually shorten times by reducing backlogs and the like. Part of the problem, what I'd like to draw attention to here, is that too many people perceive that an appeal is worthwhile. And so if we could better align the decision thresholds that are used in the initial phase and the appellate phase, then we wouldn't have we wouldn't have a system where everybody believes they need to appeal to get the right decision outcome.
So we tend to have an automatic appeal when there's a denial.
Exactly.
Which extends that period, extends that cost, and obviously, when someone's out of the workforce, it's hard for them to get back in, regardless of what the outcome is at the end of the appeal process.
And the rules, of course, do require a five-month waiting period. Right.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll yield back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marchant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of process questions. We've talked a lot today about baby boomers and their entering the system as disabled. Once a person reaches the threshold of age 62 and they have the ability to go on early retirement, what's the process that a person would go through once they've reached that threshold, and then but they don't want to take early retirement, but then they apply for Social Security disability. And then they are given, they're denied initially, and then they're given a waiting period that might take them past the time whereby they would enter the system at age 65 in full retirement. So how are the hearings determinators? I mean, how are you handling people that are entering the office with those kind of problems? And I'm not sure who to direct that question to, but perhaps somebody that has some everyday experience.
Actually, I'm just going to speak up to say that I'm probably not the person that we really need to know from Social Security, because that kind of decision happens in the field office. So I don't know if probably the closest person to Social Security is OIG here. Do you know the answer exactly? I do know that you can have a sort of a simultaneous early retirement and disability going at the same time, but I can't tell you exactly how that works. Obviously, we wouldn't double dip, but that kind of thing does occur. But I would hesitate
to
answer the question more.
So, if a person was 62 years old and they applied for total disability, and the total disability benefit was $1,000 or $1,100 a month, and they were able to receive early Social Security benefits, they can't receive Social Security benefits and be permanently and receive permanent disability. You can? No, you can't.
No.
So this whole perception of the system being weighted down and broken because of all of the baby boomers that are entering the system because they're retiring and become, you know, more and more of them are becoming disabled, there seems to be a point at which that would flatten out, because they would either go into early retirement or they would go into permanent retirement, and you wouldn't be receiving both at the same time, would you?
No, you would not receive both at the same time. I misspoke in that way.
Ms. Masters.
I can speak to that a little bit. They would not receive both at the same time, but of course the early retirement benefit is an actuarially reduced benefit, and the disability benefit is not, so they would receive a higher benefit if they are awarded disability benefits, and then at their full retirement age they just convert into the regular retirement program, but maintaining that higher benefit level.
Are any of these things taken into consideration when the initial claim is made?
One quick clarification.
So that it would be a very small cost for a person to have a combination of a partial disability benefit and a early retirement benefit. And why would someone be asked to wait 1, 2, or 3? Why would somebody wait 1, 2, or 3 years and appeal their claim if they're going to reach the threshold of retirement? Anyway, yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Congressman. A person, as Dr. Massa said, if I am 62 and I go in and apply for retirement benefits, I'm going to receive a reduced benefit, and that will happen for as long as I receive benefits. So as an individual, I'm entitled to get disability benefits until I reach my full retirement age, which I would point out is now 66 for people who are retiring now, and will go up to 67. So that it is a big disadvantage to me in terms of my income if I apply for retirement at that point. In the SSA evaluation, there is for disability, there is a piece that takes age into account in the vocational guidelines. So that is considered from that perspective when someone comes in and applies. But it is up to the individual to decide whether they want to apply for early retirement or disability. And if it is an individual who has a disability, it is in their best interest to apply for disability, because their benefit will be at the higher level as opposed to reduce for the remainder of their life.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Mr. Becerra, do you have a clarification question?
Yeah, I just wanted to be sure. Dr. Maestas, I think in
during some questioning by Mr. Berg, I think when we talked about, when you were talking about the appeals process, I think you may have mentioned that there's an automatic appeal. There aren't any automatic appeals, although a lot of claimants ultimately do file for appeal, but there's no automatic right to appeal a case to a higher level. I just wanted to clarify that, and that's the case, correct?
The appeals channel is open to everybody,
right,
but there is no automatic appeal. They decide themselves whether or not to pursue an appeal.
Right. In other words, it doesn't go to appeal immediately if the decision is against you. You have to actually
affirmatively have to initiate the appeal.
Correct.
Their lawyer decides.
Yeah. Congressman.
Thank you.
He wants to make some more money.
Ms. Ekman?
If I could also just clarify, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but we'll be happy to get that to you. But a significant portion of people who are denied at the initial level choose not to continue an appeal. So I think that's an important point, is that we aren't getting 100% appeals of the denials.
That's my understanding as well. But if you could provide those numbers to the committee, I think that would be helpful.
I have those numbers from our data. It's two-thirds, almost two-thirds, so 65% that do pursue an appeal of the initial denial, so back from 2005-06.
They do appeal?
One-third don't.
Yeah. So if you could provide those numbers, that would be great.
Those are in my testimony in the written remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Again, I want to thank you all for being here and your testimony. I look forward to continuing this discussion. Ways to secure the future of this vital program at our next hearing, which will focus on what happens when someone appeals a denied claim. I want to thank you all again for being here. We appreciate you. A great time to see the trees outside. Your perfect timing. With that, the subcommittee stands adjourned.